Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, members of the local AAPI community react to last week's mass shooting in Metro Atlanta and a rising tide of violence against Asian Americans. This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Also today, we'll check in with a UGA researcher who's using wastewater to monitor COVID case numbers.
Over the last few weeks, really since about mid-February, levels in sewage have stabilized, and in the last week, they've dropped even further.
Plus, bringing the beauty of nature to mobility-challenged individuals.
Those stories, plus our panel on Jody Heiss's announcement that he's running for Secretary of State. That's coming up on Athens News Matters.
Hours ago, halfway around the world, the day has already begun.
Tens of thousands of people in Venezuela.
Britain is leaving the European Union.
Everyone was just running. People were crying. They were in tears. And we didn't know what was happening. Police kept telling us to move back, move back.
The thousands of protesters marched along a route.
When you need to know where the world went while you weren't looking. Morning Edition. Listen every morning.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Across the country, Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders are seeing a dramatic uptick in violence against them, according to law enforcement data. And as they and we continue to process the tragic events in Metro Atlanta last week, WUGA's Isabella Liu spoke to members of the AAPI community in Athens.
Going to the grocery store, getting out of the car, walking downtown. Even the simple experiences of living can be a source of worry for Asian American parents and their children. These worries have only increased in the wake of a shooter killing six Asian women in Metro Atlanta last week. Since the pandemic began, racially charged phrases such as Kung Flu and the Chinese virus have helped spark a rise in discrimination across the country against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, also known as AAPI. But for some Asian American students at UGA, their experiences with anti-Asian discrimination predate the pandemic. According to the platform Data USA, 9% of total enrolled students at UGA are Asian. In some parts of UGA, with even smaller populations of Asian Americans, the experience can be
lonely, and it was very isolating. You know, UGA law doesn't have a lot of Asian students. I mean, we all know each other and we do support each other, but yeah, if we're talking about race, it was a very lonely experience.
That was Michelle Dudley, a Chinese-American third-year law student and member of the Asian Law Students Association. Asians comprise 5.2% of UGA law students in 2020, according to the site Public Legal. Matthew Key is the president of the UGA Asian American Student Association. He sees his initial experience at UGA as a reflection of something larger.
I still remember the first week I was at the Bolton Crosswalk and I was just getting dirty looks from people around. And I was like, that's just a completely different experience for me. It might have been culture shock as I kind of processed it more. You know, students from UGA come all over Georgia, and, you know, Asian populations and demographics aren't all over Georgia.
Navroz Durrani is a second year law student and Pakistani American. In his experience, harassment can take more subtle forms in the classroom.
Sometimes it's not even just like a random stranger. It's that, someone who you happen to be in a class with now feels kind of comfortable enough to be able to make a comment about something. And then like they kind of put you on the spot and you have to defend whatever it is that they've said.
Being the only Asian American voice in conversations can be uncomfortable and tokenizing. And for Dudley and others, it can sometimes mean watching classmates avoid the topic of race altogether.
I remember one class I was in last year, it had to do with Japanese internment camps. I just remember reading it, and then I thought we were going to have, you know, a deeper conversation about it during class. But when class happened, people were just following the logical reasoning of why it wasn't correct, not the racial implications of why it wasn't correct. And I feel like, yeah, we're in law school, so I understand like we're supposed to be talking about the law, but I feel like the law is intersectional and you have to talk about race if you're going to talk about the laws. And I thought about speaking up, but then I don't want to be like that one person who speaks for like all Asians. So I just decided to keep quiet. But now that I think back on it, I should have said something.
For Matthew Key and others, online classes have served as a buffer.
I feel like because we're in such a virtual format this year, our members have been able to avoid most of any confrontational, I guess, occurrences from happening.
For many Asian American students at UGA, they found community in AAPI organizations on campus. Students find friendship, support, and a way to reconnect with their culture in Asian American clubs. Jessie Huang is a Vietnamese American undergraduate student and president of the Vietnamese Student Association.
But surprisingly, as I entered UGA, the support was there just because you can find a community for yourself within like the AAPI community. And then I hopped on into the VSA and I was just like, yeah, this is my people. Like, I get them. They get me. We grew up the same way. Like, we had the same mentality.
And while downtown Athens is a draw for many students, nightlife can be especially hostile.
But I think generally what you see kind of play out is where people are comfortable going to different places. Like for me, there are definitely certain bars that I'm never going to step foot in Athens because I just know that like I'm not accepted there. And like that's not anywhere that I want to even try to go to.
Among his Asian American peers at UGA, Matthew Key has found not only friends, but a way to reconnect with his roots.
Being assimilated into the American culture, our, I guess, normal and national heritage kind of takes a backseat. I know for me in particular, when I was assimilating into American culture, you know, my mother language and all those things kind of fell off the wayside. And college has been a fantastic opportunity, especially with ASA, to come back to terms with that and to reconnect with my cultural identity.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Isabella Liu.
It's been a year of ups and downs for the Clark County School District, from going all virtual on short notice through various openings and closings to a phased reopening and vaccinations of teachers and district staff. Megan Wan reports on the decisions and the pushback the district made.
A lot can happen over the course of a year, something that the staff, administrators, and teachers in the Clark County School District know all too well. This time last year, Clark County schools were feeling their way around the uncharted territory of mass virtual learning. Now, CCSD is in its final phase of returning to in-person class instruction and has held mass COVID vaccinations for its teachers and staff. But what exactly has it taken to get here? Amy Roark, the director of school nursing for CCSD, says that from the beginning, the district made sure to include input from healthcare professionals when making decisions, especially concerning returns to in-person instruction, a decision CCSD has had to make multiple times in response to rapidly changing circumstances.
Even as we've, you know, taken baby steps here this way or two steps back in this direction or a big leap forward, the fact that the Clark County School District has committed to listening to a nurse, listening to science, and really focusing on the safety aspects, the mitigation aspects behind our school return gives me great confidence in the district's abilities to bring kids back safely into our buildings.
On October 9th, CCSD officially announced plans to resume in-person instruction starting November 9th. But the road to full reopening hasn't been without its detours and traffic jams, including criticisms from those within the framework, like Brent Andrews, a teacher at Cedar Shoals High School. According to Andrews, teachers received a survey in June seeking feedback on the reopening of schools. On July 7th, teachers received a letter from the district that Andrews says left him feeling frustrated and concerned.
There was no initial, how are you feeling about the return, about your health? It was very much, this is what we're doing, sign on or get off the bus.
Andrews acknowledges the difficulties the district faced and says he doesn't envy the choices they've had to make. But he also says he felt underinformed and left in the cold when CCSD was making decisions that affected his classes, despite the presence of a teacher's advisory panel. The frustration from Andrews regarding how his district has handled reopening is echoed by many other teachers across across the state. Lisa Morgan is the president of the Georgia Association of Educators and a kindergarten teacher. And she says that it's an interesting pivot because around this time last year, educators were being showered with appreciation.
It has heightened the tensions in some areas, and there's also been a disconnect in many instances between how educators feel supported by their school level administration versus how they feel supported by the district level administration.
Clark County began a phased reopening of schools on November 9th. Within a month, they had returned to virtual instruction and delayed the start of school after the holidays until January 19th due to a rise in cases. The end of 2020 and the start of 2021 came and went. Around January 21st, news broke across the nation that two Cobb County educators died from COVID-19. Not a day later, the district delayed reopening until February 5th, but those deaths made many educators uneasy.
Yeah, there was a lot of fear, anxiety, just uncertainty, people feeling that they had to choose between their actual lives and their livelihoods.
In late February, Governor Brian Kemp stated he would expand the vaccine eligibility to include teachers and school staff. For Amy Roark, there was a sense of relief. While it doesn't magically solve COVID, as pointed out by Morgan and Andrews, younger kids are still unable to receive the vaccine. Roark calls it the light at the end of the tunnel. She says that her team of school nurses were preparing for this long before the governor took to the podium, partnering with the Department of Public Health and medical schools. She says that by the time Kemp made his announcement, CCSD was well on its way to establishing the necessary infrastructure it would take to coordinate mass vaccinations for district personnel. Looking back, Roark says she thinks the district has done a pretty good job navigating the unknown terrain of the last year.
I think they got a few really important things right from the get-go. They chose to make a decision to stay virtual right before the cases escalated in the fall, and that proved to be a really, really smart decision. They opened up as soon as the community metrics got to where we thought were safe. And, you know, we were open for 4 to 5 weeks, and our contact tracing and cases grew exponentially, and they made the wise decision to revert to virtual learning, and that proved to be the right decision.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Megan Wan.
I'm Tim Franks. From the biggest breaking stories of the day to the important issues and trends, we're there.
This is an historic victory and what is a very important day.
This could change world history.
Everybody's going to pay a price. He will, everybody will.
And I am just so happy to be home and to put my feet on this land again.
Another huge development.
Join me and my colleagues for NewsHour from the BBC.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Here with me today is Michael Prochaska, editor of the Oconee County Enterprise, an award-winning weekly newspaper that specializes in local coverage. Thanks for stopping by today, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
So today we're looking for information about the sudden resignation of former Watkinsville Mayor Bob Smith during a city council meeting on Wednesday, March 17th. Can you walk us through his announcement that day and maybe what his rationale was for leaving?
The meeting started as it usually does. They approved the minutes. The mayor made a couple proclamations honoring a couple athletic groups and sports teams. And then he got up to the podium and he told the council that he had something important to say. And he read a 2-page statement that effectively was his resignation letter. Once he finished with that resignation letter, he handed it to the city clerk and he left City Hall as a private citizen. And this was a mayor who was supposed to be up for re-election this coming November. And the consequences of him resigning when he did is that the city will have to hold a special election in June. And whoever wins that special election will still need to run in November.
Since you were there, did you get a sense that perhaps other members of the council had no idea this was about to happen?
No one was really prepared for this, and no one knew about it in advance.
Interesting. Well, any news on what sort of events led to this abrupt departure?
The mayor has been feuding with the council since the first day he took office.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it has to do with the power struggle between having a city manager which the city hired someone before Mayor Bob Smith took office, and having a mayor. The mayor only gets paid a little less than $10,000 a year. The city manager makes $75,000 a year. So the city manager does most of the day-to-day work, the management of department heads, and is effectively the person who handles contractors, businesses. Our mayor is someone who wanted to be in power to do all those things that the city manager does. So fundamentally, the mayor disagreed with the power structure that the city had voted on.
What immediate impact do you think, if any, will this have on the Watkinsville community?
I honestly believe that the community is a little split. The city never held a referendum or put it up to a citizen vote to have a manager. And so there are citizens who believe that Watkinsville is too small of a town to hire a city manager and that the mayor should suffice.
Right.
The city has a population of about 3,000 people. On the other hand, there is a large group of people that believe that the city is growing and there's a lot of day-to-day work and that it requires a professional with government experience to perform duties every day. So the community is really divided on whether the city should have a powerful mayor or a manager who shares power with the mayor.
Michael Prochaska is the editor of the Oconee County Enterprise. Thanks for stopping by today.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a busy week in news and politics, and joining me now to talk about the biggest stories in and around Athens this week are Blake Aud from Flagpole Magazine, Gwen O'Looney from WXAG, and Chris Dowd from AthensPoliticsNerd.com. Let's start first with Jody Heiss, who we heard earlier this week that the 10th District Representative is going to challenge Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger in the GOP primary next year. It's early, but does Heiss have a chance to upset the incumbent?
Yeah, he does. Raffensperger is not particularly popular among Republicans because he refused Donald Trump's request to overturn the election results. And Republicans are convinced, falsely, they've been convinced by their leaders that there was some sort of massive fraud going on in the election, which is not true, but they believe it. And so they want to get rid of Raffensperger, and I think he's in big trouble.
Yeah, in a Republican primary, I think Heiss has a great shot at winning, unfortunately. I mean, he has the backing of Donald Trump, who is the leader of the party still. I believe that's true. And in Georgia, I think it's even more true. So I think it's going to be very difficult for Raffensperger to win in a Republican primary.
I just cannot believe that people will not start slowly waking up and getting back to the middle.
Well, we also don't know who else is going to be in this race. I mean, there's another candidate, David Belisle, who's the former mayor of Alpharetta. So we have to mention him. I mean, there's a lot of different factors here. With three people in the race, one of them being from Metro Atlanta, who kind of is saying a lot of the same things that Heiss is saying, but has a stronger, potentially stronger base of support in the northern suburbs of Atlanta, which are definitely turning blue, but there's still a lot of Republicans in there. That's a very populated area. I don't want to come out and say Heiss is going to, this is going to be a landslide victory for Heiss. I mean, it's a three-way race. More people could get in, and I think it's the likelihood is probably that it'll wind up in a runoff.
Let's move on to the Clark County School District, which is going back to school 5 days a week of in-person instruction. They're saying that falling case numbers of COVID is part of their decision-making process. Do you think it's the right time to take another step toward normal classroom instruction?
I think the biggest part of their decision making was that teachers became priorities for vaccination. I think that is just It should have been in the first, they should have been in category 1A. And now that they're going to have teachers, and I think the studies are showing that schools can do a good job of being safe.
That's true. Yeah, there was a new, the new CDC guidance came out a few weeks ago that talked about how you can reopen schools safely and if you have proper ventilation and things like that, and mask wearing, of course. The teachers will be, every teacher that wants to be vaccinated will be vaccinated by April 12th. That's another big factor. And our caseload in Clark County has dropped down to about 120 cases per 100,000 in the past 2 weeks, which is a measurement of how it's spreading. That's well below the 200 that the CDC says is one of the things you should look at when you're talking about reopening. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a good decision.
And we were talking about, obviously, Clark County teachers will be vaccinated by April 12th. Let's move on to the vaccine rollout. And Governor Kemp announced that starting this week, all Georgians over age 16 would be eligible for the vaccine. Given that the state still seems to be lagging behind most of the country in vaccine distribution, is this going to make things easier or harder for people?
I don't know. I think that Kemp has been trying to blame it on lack of vaccine. But the reality is that we have gotten a lot of vaccine that we haven't gotten out yet. But the other thing I think that's really important is that all the studies are showing that states that have flooded the market have created a lot of confusion, and that an organized release has served them better. So it could be that this approach of everybody's eligible now could hurt us.
Well, I think there's been a lot of confusion about who's eligible. So I'm actually glad that the governor's doing this. I think it's time. We are going to be getting a lot more vaccines. It's ramping up. We haven't even gotten hardly any of the Johnson & Johnson yet. So when that comes, you know, that'll be even more supply. The AstraZeneca one could be on the horizon. So yeah, I think reducing confusion is a good idea. You know, we've got to get these vaccines in arms. You know, as Gwen mentioned, we still have a stockpile of unused vaccines that we have to get in arms. So I think making more people eligible will make that easier. But you know, for the next week or so, there probably will be a surge because there are probably a lot of people have been waiting, and now all of a sudden they're going to try to get one. And we're having a real problem in Athens, and I just think that the demand is so high in Athens. Everybody wants it, you know, and nobody can get an appointment. And I know the health department is vaccinating 2,500 people a day. And that's still not nearly enough. And I don't know what more they can do, but, you know, people are calling around to all different pharmacies and going out of town. I know people going to Alabama, South Carolina. I went up to Habersham County. A lot of people are going to Oglethorpe County where they're doing mass vaccination events. So it's really hard to find around here. And I think it's just because everybody wants it, which is a good thing.
Right. Well, we'll just end with you having the last word because we are out of time. I want to thank my guests, Chris Dowd from Athens Politics Nerd, Gwen O'Looney from WXAG, and Blake Odd from Flagpole Magazine.
An All Things Considered story starts with the news.
Two women set to become the first female Army Rangers ever.
That day, we wanted to follow it with a conversation from a woman who was in the military.
So we just email everybody.
Whittle it down to one. We get her on the phone.
Welcome to the program, Sergeant Marquez.
Thank you very much, Audie.
I want to start just with your reaction.
There's more to every story on All Things Considered every afternoon.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. It's never too soon to set aside money for the future, whether it's saving for retirement or adding to the kids' college fund. But what if that money is going towards your student loan debt? WUGA's Devin Zwald has this report.
Can't live with them, can't live without them. That's right, I'm talking about student loans. For more than 44 million Americans, student loans have become a constant fixture in life. They impact every slice of the financial pie, including saving for retirement, buying a home, deciding when or if to have kids, and even how to pay for kids' college.
people who right now are in their 30s and early 40s at this point. This, you know, remains a very pivotal time in terms of building wealth and beginning to save for future expenses for families. Student loan debt can and does act for many as a slow drain.
That's Julie Miller, a research scientist with the MIT Age Lab. While it may seem that student loans are a plight of millennials, they impact every generation.
For many people, especially in their 40s and 50s, this is now a generation that is trying to plan for their children's future and perhaps contribute to their children's education, and yet they may still be saddled with loans. And so what I do suspect is that this is just the beginning of us looking at a whole new kind of generational conflict about how can I be supporting my own financial well-being while also contributing to the success of my children.
Amy Burke Massey is a University of Georgia alum and president of the Columbus, Georgia chapter of the UGA Alumni Association. She and her husband shared his law school student loans.
Yeah, I think it really shocked me when there was a big increase between payments. I think they shocked him too. We had just purchased a house at the time. And I mean, even though we knew it was coming, it still is not something that's fun to pay for.
Massey and her husband were able to pay off his student loans before their first child was born. But for some, these loans linger for long periods. Increasingly, parents and grandparents are having to take out loans to help pay for kids and grandkids' education, according to a report by AARP. Since the early 2000s, there has been an increase in borrowers and amount borrowed by people 50 and over. In 2004, those 50 and over owed $47.3 billion in student loans. That number had increased to $289.5 billion by 2019, according to the same AARP report. Student loan debt can also impact confidence in meeting financial goals, explains Matt Gorin, assistant professor of financial planning at the American College of Financial Services.
Folks who still have debt who haven't started saving do feel much worse. They're much more stressed out. And that stress has implications for their financial behavior. Do I feel the self-efficacy? Do I feel the confidence to do things like save and invest? People who have these loans, who have that financial stress, do feel less self-efficacy. So then that compounds the problem because they're saving and investing even later in life, or they're doing it suboptimally because maybe they're afraid to ask for help or embarrassed to ask for help.
Speaking of asking for help, both Gorin and Miller expressed the need for having more conversations about money. Here's Miller again.
We have heard this theme of, in our family, we don't talk about loans. We don't talk about money in general. Part of moving forward and hopefully helping people to repay their loans most efficiently is to destigmatize the issue of loans and debt and money more generally within families.
Despite the financial hardships that come with student loans, being willing to have conversations about money can be helpful because, according to Gorin,
should people go to college? Emphatically, yes. Because if you don't go to college, you simply can't get a lot of these good jobs. Some college degrees do not have a very good return on investment. Other degrees tend to have extremely good return on investment.
Massey thinks the investment was worth it.
Yes, absolutely. I think it gave him the ability to, you know, really round out his education. So would he be where he is now without that? I don't think so. So, you know, in the end, I think it was certainly worth it.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Devin Zwald.
Recently named a Rhodes Scholar, Phaedra Buchanan is a senior at the University of Georgia majoring in social studies education and minoring in German. She is also the first African-American Rhodes Scholar from UGA. Phaedra, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with talking about the Rhodes Scholarship itself. What does it mean to be selected?
My understanding of the Rhodes Scholarship is that, at least in the United States, I'm one of 32 students from universities across the country And we're specifically chosen because of our academic record and then a desire to give back to the world. I think it's that simple, but you apply, go through a pretty rigorous interview process, and then you're chosen on the same day that you interview. So the first section would be something of a cocktail hour. It's very bizarre applying for the Rhodes Scholarship in the pandemic and everything is over Zoom. A virtual cocktail hour, which was interesting, but still great conversation, surprisingly great conversation where the panelists get to know you and you get to know the panelists, which is important because the main interview, you are sitting on a panel with five or six other people. Most of them were former Rhodes Scholars. And then for where I'm from, it was also Jason Carter, Jimmy Carter's grandson, interviewing me, and they can ask you just about anything.
So what opportunities will you have access to because of the scholarship?
Right. So this is going to allow me to study at the University of Oxford. I'll be completing a two-year program, and it'll cover the cost of that and some living expenses. It also connects me to the other Rhodes Scholars from around the world and then past Rhodes Scholars, which is, in my opinion, a huge benefit of the scholarship.
Well, the Rhodes Scholarship has historically been criticized for a lack of diversity, excluding women until 1977, and then limiting the number of people of color accepted. What does it mean to be the first African-American UGA student to be accepted to the scholarship?
I definitely have mixed feelings about it. Mm. On the one hand, I feel a sense of joy and pride that now that I am the first, this is no longer an institution where African-Americans didn't have that opportunity. And I'm glad about that. At the same time, there's something very sad about being the first African-American Rhodes Scholar in 2021, because it means that before me, no one has gotten this opportunity. And I hope that I can use the Rhodes Scholarship in a way that one day we won't be counting first African-American this or that, that these will just be opportunities that are open to different groups.
So beyond the classroom, what are you looking to do with your social studies education at UGA?
At first, I came to the University of Georgia thinking that I would be a math teacher because I had tutored in math for so long. I was very comfortable with it. But I really sat with myself and thought about the impact I wanted to have on students. And I thought back to those teachers I mentioned earlier, and I hope that I can help students explore the world and their place in it in the same way. What's been great about studying social studies education at the University of Georgia is that it's taught me so much about teaching, yes, but also about the field of education as a whole. I've learned about what it means to be a teacher inside and outside of the classroom, how difficult it can be and how it affects our lives. And one thing I hope to gain from studying at the University of Oxford is how people have dealt with issues of education beyond teaching in the past. I hope that one day I might get into education policy or other advocacy work, trying to improve the lives of teachers like myself.
Phaedra Buchanan is a senior at the University of Georgia. She is also the first African-American Rhodes Scholar from UGA.
Here's an unpleasant but true fact. Our sewage tells us a lot about the overall health of our community. And while the more public forms of coronavirus testing have gotten a lot of notice, a UGA researcher and her team have been studying wastewater to fill out the picture of how widespread COVID-19 is in Athens. That researcher is Erin Lipp, and I spoke to her earlier this week. Here's our conversation. So typically, when most people think of COVID testing, we think of individual nasal swabs or saliva tests that we see reported through various sources, Department of Public Health, dog check, similar venues. How does your research add to the overall picture of coronavirus spread?
So what we're looking at is essentially a pooled sample of thousands of people at a time within our community in Athlones Clark County. So the evidence has suggested that when people are infected with the SARS coronavirus, even if they're not symptomatic, they're shedding the virus in their feces. So basically, that goes down the drain. It goes into our sewage systems, and we can pick it up at our local wastewater treatment plants. So what we're able to do is to test a 24-hour composite sample that's sort of an integration of what's happening over the community at large. So we're able to essentially screen for levels of virus for thousands of people at a particular time rather than an individual.
And can you tell us a little bit about how this monitoring started?
Yeah, so we actually got started early last summer, pretty much right as the cases were starting to pick up pretty dramatically in Athens and in Georgia in general. And this was really part of a larger effort that's going on across the United States and even the world to look at what's called wastewater-based epidemiology. And the idea is that you can tell a lot about what's happening in a community by looking at what's flushed down the toilet. So we started doing weekly samplings back in late May and early June, and we've continued that until now. And with the help of Athens Clark County resources, we increased that to twice weekly starting last October. So we've really been able to look at an epidemic curve based on the pooled sample of the entire community at the same time that we're also seeing case reports come in from Department of Public Health.
And what does your research tell us about the spread of coronavirus in our community?
So through the course of the outbreak, our results tracked really well with what we were seeing in terms of case reports. We were often able to see increases before we saw the reported cases, which is consistent with what others have seen in other communities. So we saw big spikes in August with the return of UGA students. We also saw big spikes over the winter holidays and then early in January. And really since then, we've started to see a decline over the last few weeks. Really since about mid-February, levels in sewage have stabilized. And in the last week, they've dropped even further.
That's pretty encouraging.
Yeah, so I think between the number of people getting vaccinated, the evidence that our case reports are declining, I think it's an encouraging sign that we're seeing some real improvements around the county.
Dr. Erin Lipp is a professor of environmental health science in UGA's College of Public Health.
Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
This spring, UGA Extension is teaming up with WUGA to answer your gardening questions on the air. The Clark County Cooperative Extension offers free, dependable resources and advice on everything from healthy eating to youth development to planting tomatoes. My name is Laura Ney. I'm the Agriculture and Natural Resources Agent for Clark County, and I'm here to answer your questions. To have your questions answered on the air, please send them to wuga@uga.edu with garden question in the subject line. That's wuga@uga.edu. Include your name and phone number with your garden question. Happy gardening.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. One of the best things about spring for many of us is getting out to experience nature. But for people who are mobility challenged, accessibility can be a constant challenge. It's one that the State Botanical Garden of Georgia is taking on, as Jessica Wurst reports.
Every year, thousands of people come to the State Botanical Garden of Georgia, drawn by the 33 acres of cultivated space and some 280 acres of natural areas. But for those with strollers, wheelchairs, scooters, canes, and walkers, not all of those natural areas, like the wooded paths, are accessible. But garden staff are working on changing that.
It was late afternoon and the sun was setting and the reflection in the water was just perfect.
That's Mike Sykes describing the view from the Middle Oconee River from his recent trip to the Botanical Garden with Connie Cottingham. Sykes has worked at the garden for several years, and Cottingham just retired after 16 years of service. Obviously, these two are no strangers to the garden. But this visit was a little more special, thanks to the new ADA-accessible trail, which allows Mike to venture into the natural areas of the garden with his scooter, which he says was difficult before, due to mud and tree roots.
Well, it's the wonderful the way it's set up. They have parking. It's down in the lower part of the garden, so you follow the road down, and then there's actually two handicaps and several other parking spaces. And then our scooter fits in the trunk of the car. So, and we got it out, and I've been dying to go see it because I'd heard about it, but it was amazing.
It was quite a distance. So you got to enjoy nature on the way. It's not like you get out of the car, look at the river, and get back in the car. It was an experience.
According to Sykes, more people may benefit from the trail than you might think.
It's not just for handicapped. Older visitors to the garden can access this and use it. It's a smaller, you know, my 80-something-year-old mother could walk this path, but she couldn't do those woodland paths. So it opens up to a lot of people.
One of those groups includes bird watchers, or birders.
The State Botanical Gardens was actually designated the first important bird area in Georgia, and it's really diverse for birds. 184 species have been recorded there in total because of the variety of habitats. One of the best areas in the botanical garden for seeing birds is actually the strip between the power line cut and the Oconee River.
That was Richard Hall, assistant professor in the Odum School of Ecology and the Department of Infectious Diseases at UGA. He says that the new path allows mobility-challenged birders to fully experience the diverse range of birds that come to this rich area.
In the past, it could be a challenge for some of our mobility-impaired, like birdwatchers in the Athens area, to get down into those habitats. And now this great ADA-accessible trail that goes from the lower parking area to the river provides access to these really incredible habitats for birdwatchers.
The botanical garden also has new boardwalks that make it easier to walk the trails, according to garden director Jennifer Cruz Sanders.
We have a beaver pond, and the thought was to create a boardwalk over that area in the natural areas and increase the access to the flooded area and give people better views of the natural areas and trees and birds in that area.
The improvements so far are really just the beginning, says Cruz Sanders.
We received a generous donation to do a natural areas master plan that will allow us to study how we can continue bringing accessible trails into the natural areas. So I think we'll begin to work on additional trails in the near future.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Jessica Wurst.
A new biography about the life of beloved musician Colonel Bruce Hampton titled The Music and Mythocracy of Colonel Bruce Hampton, a basically true biography, comes out in April. The biography spans Hampton's long musical career. Joining us today is the author, award-winning journalist Jerry Grillo. Now, can you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write this biography?
Well, what inspired me was actually meeting Colonel Bruce, because he was just so interesting. I mean, he had this long career, played with some incredible bands, because the more I got to know him, the more I dug into his music, and all these people were telling me, how have you not heard about this genius? And he was just a very funny, convivial person. We got along really well over baseball trivia. That was kind of the thing that got us together over lunch. And his career just fascinated me. So when I asked Bruce permission, he acted as if he was expecting the question. He was that kind of guy. He said, I was wondering when you would ask, in that deep voice of his. And that's how the process started, basically.
He seemed to have a profound effect on his friends and fellow musicians. What about Colonel Bruce Hampton left such a mark on people?
I think one of the things is he made everybody feel like they were his best friend. I've met a lot of people who have said, you know, I've lost my best friend. And they're serious about it. But I think on the other side, because he had such a great memory of personal details like their birthdays and their children's names and, you know, their father's and mother's names, this kind of thing. And of course, sometimes he seemed like he knew it ahead of time. Sometimes he'd guess these things about it. It made you feel close to him. I always thought of him as a people collector as well as a people connector. I mean, he connected people, and I think he got great joy in that, and watching, you know, sort of friendships happen.
Right. And what is one of your most memorable stories about Hampton?
I was going backstage to see him at a show in Clarksville, Georgia, in what used to be an old mill, a cotton mill, and is now a bowling alley with a performance space. And I'm bringing my wife with me. She had never met him to this point. I no sooner walked through the door, I came in first and opened the door for her to come in. She comes into the room. He's sitting there and he points at her, right at her, like this big finger, you know, from across the room. Jane Grillo. You know, he proceeds immediately to say Scorpio. And then he gets the correct, you know, moon, wherever her moon phase was, all of it was boom, 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 right on. And, you know, it's hard to surprise my wife. I mean, I've tried, right? But her mouth hit the floor. And there have been a number of those stories, often around birthdays and the looks on people's faces and what it meant to them too. For the other memorable stuff, you just have to pick up the book.
Jerry Grillo is an award-winning journalist and author of the forthcoming book, The Music and Mythocracy of Colonel Bruce Hampton, a basically true biography.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more. Until then, stay safe.